Well, tonight is going to be a little bit of an odd sermon. I'm going to be picking up on some of the themes that I was talking about at the Banner Borders conference on Friday and Saturday, although not in an identical way. It's odd in that I'm kind of going to be preaching on the text that you may have seen on the slides as you came in today, Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." But although that is sort of my text, I'm going to, for quite a bit of time this evening, just talk about the Beatitudes generally and how they work, because there's no point in diving into one Beatitude if we don't understand the logic and how the whole thing works as a unit. So I warn you of that. And I also just want to say then that to the extent that I do talk about peacemaking this evening, I'm not doing that because of any situation that I'm aware of existing amongst the congregation. It's always dangerous when you preach on a very specific matter that people think that there must be something that you're addressing in the congregation. I'm not preaching it for that reason at all, but rather just to equip us all, because peacemaking is an important part of the Christian life, and we all need to be equipped then for such a time as may arise in our lives when we need to be engaging in that kind of ministry. So with regard to this section then of Matthew 5 that we do generally entitle the Beatitudes, it seems to me that although it's such a famous passage, indeed even perhaps still today, there would be quite a number of people who don't darken the doors of church buildings and yet would know the Beatitudes, or at least have heard of them. Despite it being so famous, I think it's possible for us as Christians to be quite muddled in our ideas about them and to have a wrong notion then of what is going on here. In particular, I think we often have this kind of idea about the Beatitudes, that Jesus here is commanding us to be poor in spirit and to mourn and to be meek and so on. That is to say, the Beatitudes are this series of searching, challenging commands. Now, Jesus is certainly not averse to issuing searching, challenging commands. Indeed, he'll do plenty of that in this sermon that he's beginning here, what we call the Sermon on the Mount. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Do not lay up for yourselves treasure on earth. Do not be anxious about tomorrow. Whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. Now, you don't have to be an expert in grammar to appreciate those are commands, imperatives, to use the fancy term. But nor do you have to be an expert in grammar to appreciate that the Beatitudes are not. They're rather statements. They are assertions. They are propositions. Jesus knew full well how to declare a command. And he could have done so here. He could have said, be poor in spirit, mourn, be meek, etc. But instead, he speaks in this different way. And defining then the Beatitudes as statements rather than commands, that's not splitting hairs. It markedly affects the tone of them all. You see, each Beatitude, as you know, includes within it a clause beginning with the word for. Blessed are da-da-da-da for da-da-da. Blessed are da-da-da-da for da-da-da-da. Now, if Jesus in each Beatitude is issuing a command, then the clause beginning with the word for, it expresses the consequence of, the reward for, obeying the command. So you practice poverty of spirit, and as a result, you inherit the kingdom of heaven. You're merciful, and as a result, you receive mercy. That's the logic. If Jesus is issuing commands here, that's how it works. That's the logic of the Beatitudes. If, however, each Beatitude is in fact making a statement rather than issuing a command, then something else is going on here. And at this point, then, we need to stop beating about the bush and pin down exactly what is going on here and how Matthew 5, 3 to 10 does work. And I want to put it to you then that each beatitude needs to be understood in terms of three basic components. In each one, there's an assumption. In each one, there's an appearance. And in each one, there's an assurance. So in each beatitude, there's an assumption. Jesus just assumes that his disciples, and always remember he is addressing his disciples here, we know that from verse 1. Jesus just assumes that his disciples bear these traits. They are meek, they are merciful, they are pure in heart. It just comes with the territory. A self-assertive disciple of Jesus who puts himself first and throws his weight around, that's a contradiction in terms. A merciless disciple of Jesus, uninterested in the needs and predicaments of others, it's a contradiction in terms. An impure disciple of Jesus, whose heart is a cesspit of dirty thoughts and sordid imaginations, it's a contradiction in terms. It's like a left-wing conservative, or a claustrophobic coal miner, or a plump ballet dancer. Such things are jarring and incongruous because it may be assumed that a conservative will lean at least moderately to the right, and it may be assumed that a coal miner will have no problem with enclosed spaces, and it may be assumed that a ballet dancer will have a slender physique. And in the same way, it may be assumed then that a disciple of Jesus will be meek and will be merciful and will be pure in heart. These traits can exist in different degrees, of course. And certainly it's true that as Christians we're always working towards having them more, towards being poorer in spirit and having a deeper hunger and thirst for righteousness and mourning with greater sincerity the sins and sadnesses of the present evil age. We never in this life master any of these things, but these things are there, I'm saying. The Holy Spirit doesn't come and dwell in our lives at conversion for nothing. He comes in order to engender a certain lifestyle, and that lifestyle may look a little different from one believer to another according to the different contours of our personalities and situations, but in every case, it's this lifestyle, the lifestyle that comprises poverty of spirit and hungering and thirsting for righteousness and purity of heart. And so, as I say, Jesus just assumes here. In each beatitude, there's an assumption. But then, in each beatitude, there's an appearance. By which I mean this. It appears that living like this, in this world of ours, is profoundly disadvantageous. It appears a mug's game to live like this. On the face of things, it just doesn't pay to practice this lifestyle. It sets you back. You lose out by having these traits. You lose out by being meek, because it's the ruthless who invariably rise to the top of the ladder and command the mega salaries. You lose out by being pure in heart, because to be pure in heart, you have to tear out your right eye and deny yourself some of the hit TV series and iconic films that everyone else is talking about, because there are scenes in them that will damage you and defile you. You lose out by mourning over the messed up nature of the world around you and of your own heart, because it's far more fun to be in denial of all that and just eat and drink and be merry. You lose out by being merciful towards the needy and helpless, because doing that is all give, 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 whereas it's far more gratifying to get, get, get. You lose out by being persecuted for righteousness' sake. Of course you do, because persecution strips you of ever such valuable things like your possessions and your social standing and your freedom and perhaps even your life. I'm saying these standard characteristics of the Christian disciple, they seem like albatrosses. They appear to hamstring and handicap the believer, leaving him or her a rather pitiable creature. In each beatitude, there's an appearance. But then crucially, in each beatitude, there's also an assurance. In each case, Jesus effectively says, don't be taken in by the appearance. dispel all thoughts of being disadvantaged by living like this. There's nothing disadvantaged about you. You're blessed. You're blessed. Now, I don't think the word blessed that's been used here is being used in a particularly technical sense. It's perhaps a bit cumbersome and inelegant, but I don't think it's barking up the wrong tree to read these verses like this. In a great situation are the poor in spirit. In a great situation are those who mourn. In a great situation are the meek. In a great situation are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and so on. That's essentially what Jesus is conveying here. And in each case, then, the reason that Jesus' disciples practicing this lifestyle are, in fact, contrary to all appearances, in a great situation, the reason is given in the clause beginning with the word for. And what you need to understand about all those clauses beginning with the word for is that they refer to the age to come. Notice that in the first beatitude and in the last beatitude, it's "for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Later in this sermon, in chapter 7, verses 21 and 22, Jesus will talk about entering the kingdom of heaven as a last day thing, a last day phenomenon. So that it's likely the kingdom of heaven here too has reference to the future. And it's a very standard Hebraic literary device to flag up the theme of a particular section, a particular unit, by mentioning that theme at the beginning and mentioning it again at the end. The bracketing technique is how scholars sometimes refer to that. So that when here, the first beatitude and the last beatitude both look forward to the future kingdom of heaven, it's flagging up that all the beatitudes in between are also looking forward to the kingdom of heaven. In some cases, that's obvious anyway, isn't it? They shall inherit the earth. Well, that's obviously only going to happen in the age to come. They shall see God. We know from places in Revelation and elsewhere that that's going to happen in the age to come. But I'm saying then that whether it's very obvious or whether it's a bit less obvious, each beatitude looks forward to the age to come. And Jesus' assurances then, they work like this. Here are his disciples, as we said, seemingly losing out because they are practicing meekness. And he's saying to them, you don't need to gain those high-flying positions that society only extends to the ruthless and the self-promoting. Because one day you're going to gain the earth, no less. One day God is going to unveil a renewed creation. And he's going to say to you, it's all yours. That's not losing out. You're in a great situation. And here are his disciples seemingly losing out because they are practicing heart purity. And he's saying to them, you can afford to deny yourself visual experiences that others may regard as unmissable. Because one day you're going to see God himself. One day your eyes are going to feast on the very sublimest sight that there is, the glory and majesty and splendor of the Holy Trinity. That's not losing out. You're in a great situation. And here are his disciples seemingly losing out because they mourn. And he's saying to them, you can afford to forego the relentless escapism that so many people around you pursue. Distracting themselves 24/7 through revelry and frivolity from the realities of sin and the curse. You can afford to groan and sigh and weep because one day you're going to be comforted. One day your heavenly Father is going to bend down and dab your cheeks so gently and so tenderly you will never have felt so loved in your life. You'll feel that every tear was worth it just to experience this. That's not losing out. You're in a great situation. And here are his disciples seemingly losing out because they are being merciful. And he's saying to them, you can afford the inconvenience of helping others, alleviating their burdens, because one day you are going to receive mercy. One day you're going to stand before God, helpless, hell-deserving wretches, and God is going to announce you're forgiven. All your debts are cancelled. And you are thus going to be the recipients of immeasurably more mercy than you could possibly have extended to others had you had 10 lifetimes here on earth. That's not losing out. You're in a great situation. So I hope all this is clear to you then. I'm saying in each beatitude, there's an assumption. This is how Christians live. In each beatitude, there's an appearance. Christians seem to be disadvantaged through living like this. And in each beatitude, there's an assurance. In the light of the age to come, Christians are not at all disadvantaged through living like this. They're in a great situation. Which brings us then to this beatitude that I said we would, at least for part of our time, particularly focus on, the one in verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." And just in our last few minutes then, I want us to analyze it in terms of these same three components that we've just been talking about. And so first of all, the assumption. The assumption. Just as Jesus assumes that all the other characteristics mentioned in this passage are there in his disciples, he assumes too that his disciples are peacemakers. That it's in the DNA of the born-again person. Peace, as you all know, is part of the fruit of the Spirit. Remember, it's always very important that we do not confuse the fruit of the Spirit with the gifts of the Spirit. Now, Paul says of the latter, the gifts of the Spirit, in 1 Corinthians 12, verses 8 to 11, he says, "For to one is given such and such, and to another is given such and such, and to another is given such and such." And he concludes those verses, doesn't he? The Spirit apportions to each one individually as he wills. In other words, we don't all possess the same spiritual gifts. We're not meant to. If we did possess the same gifts of the Spirit, then remember Paul says we'd be like a body in which every organ is an eye, or a body in which every organ is an ear. It'd be ridiculous. No, not every gift of the Spirit is meant to be found in every Christian. We mustn't think it's the same when it comes to the fruit of the Spirit. As though those 9 items that Paul mentions in Galatians 5, 22 and 23 are kind of distributed across the church so that to one is given love, to another joy, to another peace, to another patience, and so on. No, it's fruit of the Spirit, singular, fruit, not fruits of the Spirit, fruit of the Spirit. There is one indivisible fruit comprising all these different facets which the Spirit invariably produces in every person whom he indwells. And one facet then of this one indivisible fruit that the Spirit produces in every believer, one facet is peace. And it doesn't mean, when it says peace there in Galatians 5, love, joy, peace, it doesn't mean an inner calm. It doesn't mean an internal serenity. That's not what the Spirit produces in believers. It's often been thought that it is. And so here's a believer and she struggles with depression. Here's a believer and he has anxiety disorder. Here's a believer who has nightmares every night in bed. And, oh, well, this can't be a real believer then. Must be a fake because there's no peace there. Where's the fruit of the Spirit? But it's not talking about psychological peace. It's talking about relational peace. The pursuit of peace in one's own and others' relationships. That is to say, the Spirit produces in every Christian a deep attraction to unity and concord and relational harmony. And actually where that kind of peace is absent, where the professing Christian is instead a troublemaker who gossips and slanders and creates factions and splits churches, actually then you can write off that person and say, well, this person cannot be a genuine believer. Which is precisely what Paul does in some very solemn passages in the New Testament. I've often quoted to you Titus chapter 3, verse 10, where Paul says very starkly, warn a divisive person once, and then warn him a second time. After that, have nothing to do with him. Every genuine believer, you see, hates strife and conflict and friction. And coming into close proximity with it then, or close proximity to it, perhaps I should say, every genuine believer will try to do something to remedy it. We'll try to help that husband and wife whose marriage is unraveling. We'll try to help those two Christians whose friendship has broken down. We'll try to help that family in which the parents and the offspring are pulling in two opposite directions. We'll try to help that church where the atmosphere is becoming tense and toxic. Jesus is assuming that every genuine believer loves peace and will want to help where peace is conspicuous by its absence. He's assuming that the spirit-indwelt person cannot look at Christians having a bust-up and just shrug and say, oh, well, it's just one of those things, they'll live. Any more than a Christian can look at other Christians who are having an extramarital affair and just shrug and say, oh, well, it's one of those things, they'll live. No, the spirit-indwelt person will do something. When conflict rears its ugly head and it's nearby, it's within reach, something can be done to help. Some peacemaking effort can be made. The spirit-indwelt person will try to help, will try to bring peace into that situation, will reach for the oil to pour on the troubled water, will roll up his or her sleeves and get involved in some peacemaking. That's what Jesus is assuming here, that his disciples just are. Instinctively and irrepressibly peacemakers. Which takes us on secondly to the appearance. The appearance. Because you see, peacemaking, like these other virtues that are in our passage, which we've already talked about this evening, peacemaking doesn't appear on the face of things to have much going for it. I was listening to an interview on the radio the other day with a woman called Liz McConaghy. She spent 17 years flying with the RAF's Chinook fleet. For many years, she was the only female member of that fleet. And in 2003, she was the youngest aircrew to be deployed to Iraq. And she's recently written a book about her experiences. But in the interview I was listening to, she was asked how she first got into this line of work. And she said she just always, even as a child and then as a teenager, she always wanted a job that was different and that would kind of stand out from the usual predictable range of occupations. And one day then she saw this picture on a desk somewhere. She saw a picture of a Chinook helicopter and someone dangling on a wire out of this helicopter, and she immediately said, that's what I want to do. Now, I guess that for many of us, if we're honest, maybe not dangling from helicopters, but doing things in life that stand out a bit and attract attention and get us noticed, it appeals to us. Peacemaking is not one of those things. There's that caricature, isn't there, in our culture of train spotting. Apologies to anyone whose favorite hobby is train spotting, but it's, according to the caricature at least, it's kind of the quintessential, unexciting and unglamorous thing to do. Well, peacemaking is a bit like that. Peacemaking goes under the radar. No one shouts about peacemakers. Their work tends to be very much in the background and unacknowledged. I mean, think of a silly example. Think of a Premier League football match, and two players then get into a scuffle on the pitch. They're pushing and shoving each other. And the next day then, the back pages of the newspapers feature dramatic shots of these two guys squaring up to each other, their teeth bared. And in workplaces up and down the land, men are talking about it. Did you see so-and-so and so-and-so last night having that scrap on the pitch? But no one talks about that other player who came along and separated them before things got really nasty and any punches were thrown. and who pulled his teammate away from the situation and reasoned with him and calmed him down. Pictures of that happening don't sell newspapers, and so no pictures of it are on the back of the newspapers. That player saved his teammate from a red card. That player saved his club from a fine from the Football Association. That player saved one or both of the protagonists from a broken nose and a trip to A&E that night. And yet his heroics appear in none of the post-match analysis and in none of the match reports. And if peacemaking then goes unnoticed on a football pitch that is smothered with cameras and on which the eyes of the world are trained, certainly it goes unnoticed in the far more ordinary settings in which you and I may be doing it. Which makes it then a bit uninviting, this business of peacemaking. I mean, when it's possible to start your own YouTube channel and become an influencer with millions of subscribers without even stepping out of your front door, when it's possible to do things that will give you a platform and some visibility among your fellow human beings, why would you get your hands dirty with this quiet, out-of-sight work of listening patiently to people's complaints against each other, getting those people to sit down together in the same room, thawing the frosty atmosphere between them with the warmth of your manner and your words, identifying what precisely are the key issues and the sticking points in this relationship between them, being gentle and de-escalatory while at the same time prepared to call out sin and demand repentance. Why would you? Why would you do this? Why wouldn't you do something else instead that gets you much more acknowledged than peacemaking does? Which takes us on to the third thing, the assurance. Because Jesus says then that his disciples aren't to be pitied because they go around doing this terribly unacknowledged thing. No, he says they are blessed. They are in a great situation. For, he says, they shall be called sons of God. And it's that word called, I think, that is the key word there. He's saying that the day is coming when we're going to be acknowledged, all right. We believers are going to be acknowledged one day. The day is coming when all men and all angels will notice us believers, all right. They will stare at us, in fact, open-mouthed, and say, wow, these people are sons of God. Both the Apostle Paul and the Apostle John talk about this day. John does in 1 John chapter 3, the first few verses of that chapter, famous verses. And you remember how he says there that we are right now children of God. But he says, the world does not know us. And the reason for that is that there is, of course, this huge mismatch, isn't there, presently, between our actual status and our physical condition. Our actual status is we are children of God. Our physical condition is one of great weakness and ordinariness. I mean, you look around this room this evening and we have the same number of walking sticks, the same number of balding heads, the same number of streaming noses as you get in any other gathering in Newcastle today. So that no random person would walk in to this gathering off the streets and say, crumbs, what a splendid assembly of people this is. These must be children of God. But John continues in that passage. Now we are children of God, he says. And what we will be has not yet been made known, but when he appears, we shall be like him. He's saying on that day in the experience of resurrection and glorification, the mismatch will disappear. our physical condition will on that day be brought into conformity with our actual status. Finally, we shall look like what we are, and in fact, what we were all along. And Paul then talks about the same thing in Romans chapter 8. Remember how he says there, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. And it's the same idea then, that our sonship is presently hidden, obscured by the realities of illness and aging and our inexorable slide toward the grave. But you see, on that day, in the experience of resurrection and glorification or the redemption of our bodies, as he puts it in that passage, our true identity is going to be made plain for all to see. Actually, Paul says something quite remarkable in that passage in Romans 8. He describes that unveiling on that coming day, he describes it as our adoption. We wait eagerly, he says, for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. And you feel like saying, but Paul, you everywhere teach in your letters that we're already adopted. We're already sons of God. To which I think Paul would reply, yes. But on that day, your sonship is going to enter such a new phase of visibility and perceptibleness and unmissableness, it will almost be like it's actually been inaugurated there and then on that day. And Jesus then, in this reference to us being called sons of God, he's talking about the same thing that John's talking about and Paul's talking about. He's talking about that same public unveiling of our sonship on the last day as we're raised from the dead and as our lowly bodies are transformed so that they are like his glorious body. And the point is then that no one then will call us deluded like they call us deluded now. No one then will call us a bunch of fruitcakes like they call us a bunch of fruitcakes now. No one then will call us religious fanatics as they call us religious fanatics now. Everyone rather will look at us and be compelled to say, crumbs, these are sons of God. Every man, every woman, every angel, every demon will be unable to suppress the cry, wow, these people are the sons of God. And the logic of this beatitude then is the same as the others that I talked about earlier. Here are Jesus' disciples seemingly losing out because they keep getting involved in this very unnoticed work of peacemaking. And Jesus is saying, you can afford to be unnoticed. You can afford to go without much in the way of acknowledgement. Because one day, as you shine in dazzling resurrection glory, you'll be acknowledged, all right. You'll be acknowledged by the entire cosmos as God's sons and God's daughters. That's not losing out. You're in a great situation. And so in the light of Jesus' assurance, Christian believer, do not lose heart. If you're called to make peace, and it's messy, and it's toilsome, and it's time-consuming, and you don't get your name up in lights for doing it, and no one really notices what you're doing because it's all behind closed doors, just mediating in that petty squabble between two friends of yours, seeking to help that congregation you know where all hell is breaking loose in disunity. Don't grow weary in this work. Don't opt instead for something that will get you noticed more. The noticing's going to come. The acknowledgement's going to come. You don't need acknowledgement now. There'll be acknowledgement, all right, on that great day. And I just want to close this evening with an example of peacemaking because I think it's beautiful and hopefully will inspire you as we go away thinking about this theme. And also, actually, it underlines the point I've been making about it being unnoticed, this work of peacemaking, because the peacemaking that I'm going to close with now is by a man whose name nearly all of you will be familiar with, but perhaps have never thought of as a peacemaker. And that man is John Calvin. And as a caricature of John Calvin, that he was a very fiery character and very doer. But behind the scenes, in the background, throughout his great ministry, which had such an extraordinary impact on Western Europe, he was constantly writing letters. And many of those letters, and his letters are very much worth reading, many of those letters are specifically written into situations of conflict where he is trying to make peace. And in this particular example, then, he writes a letter to fellow reformer Heinrich Bullinger, Swiss reformer. This was in 1544. Martin Luther had just, at that time, written a very inflammatory work entitled Short Confession Concerning the Supper, so a work on the Lord's Supper. And this work then, obviously, many of you will know, Martin Luther had a very distinctive and not a very helpful, not a very biblical view of the Lord's Supper, and he was arguing for that in this work, and doing so in a very vitriolic manner, attacking others in the Reformed churches, like Calvin, like Bullinger, and like many others. And Calvin then, who, as I say, was one of the objects of Luther's attacks, Calvin was not worried about that. What he was worried about was that Bullinger would react to what Luther had written and would lash out against Luther, and that this would just escalate and be a very nasty and a very unpleasant situation. And so he writes this letter to Bullinger, pleading with Bullinger not to respond, not to respond to what Luther had written vitriolically about him. And this is what he writes. He says, "I hear that Luther has at length broken forth in fierce invective." So I hear that Luther has written in a very fierce and vitriolic manner. "Not so much against you as against all of us." He says, I can scarcely ask you to completely keep silence, because it's neither just that innocent persons should thus be harassed, nor that they should be denied the opportunity of clearing themselves. So he's saying, I can't insist that you remain completely silent on this. But this is how he continues. He said, this I do desire. This I do desire. I desire to put you in mind of how eminent a man Luther is, and the excellent endowments wherewith he is gifted, with what strength of mind and resolute constancy, with how great skill, with what efficiency and power of doctrinal statement he hath hitherto devoted his whole energy to overthrow the reign of Antichrist, and at the same time to diffuse far and near the doctrine of salvation. Listen to this sentence from Calvin. He says, "Often I have declared that even although he," that's Luther, "were to call me a devil," and Luther probably did call Calvin a devil more than once, "I should still not the less hold him in such honor that I must acknowledge him to be an illustrious servant of God." He continues, "But while he is endued with rare and excellent virtues, he labors at the same time under serious faults. Would that he had rather studied to curb this restless, uneasy temperament, which is so apt to boil over in every direction. I wish, moreover, that he had always bestowed the fruits of that vehemence of natural temperament upon the enemies of the truth, and that he had not flashed his lightning sometimes upon the servants of the Lord. Would that he had been more observant and careful in the acknowledgement of his own vices." But then he concludes, "It is our part, however, so to reprove whatever evil we may see in Luther, as that we may also make some allowance for him on the basis of the remarkable endowments with which the Lord has gifted him. This, therefore, I would beseech you to consider, that you have to do with a most distinguished servant of Christ, to whom we are all of us largely indebted. I wish that you would consider and reflect on these things, rather than on what Luther has deserved by his violence. Even should he have provoked us, we ought to decline the contest." What wonderful peacemaking words from a man who himself was under such attack from Luther. And yet he says, "Don't get involved, Bullinger. Just stay out of it." A man who, contrary to the caricature, in an unacknowledged and unnoticed way, was constantly writing letters to make peace. So may God help us to be on the lookout for situations where we can exercise this important ministry. I'm often struck by Stephen in the book of Acts. And we hold Stephen up on this pedestal, don't we, as this amazing man, because he was an amazing man. So full of wisdom and of the Spirit, Luke says. The first martyr of the Christian church. And yet, what was Stephen first chosen for? He was chosen to help in that conflict situation in the Jerusalem church. These widows and tensions between the Greek-speaking ones, the Hebrew-speaking ones. A man of Stephen's caliber was brought in to make peace, because peacemaking is such a dignified and a beautiful work. May God bless his work to us. Amen.